Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the TE Podcast by Developing Lafayette. My name is Ben Powers. I'm your host, and what we like to do with this podcast is we like to invite different business owners, different community influencers in Lafayette Parish that really highlight Lafayette Parish and what we're all about. Anything from new business, new construction, new renovation, or anything in between that really helps Lafayette shine for those outside of our community. Welcome, everybody, to the tea. Again, it is Friday. Every Friday, we do the tea. Today, I have with me Kate Dorio. Kate Dorio is a, in my humble opinion, a very well-known name in people that are involved with developments and anything in Lafayette. So I'll let you kind of introduce yourself and kind of put up a perspective of what you do real quick.
Well, thanks for having me, first of all.
Sure thing.
I've been following Developing Lafayette for a long time and really like what you're doing. And I always think that you find out first, it seems like. So keep up the good work.
Well, I appreciate it.
I'm from Opelousas originally. I left home to go to college in Oregon and studied journalism and worked as a journalist in Oregon, in Portland at the CBS affiliate. I used to be in TV news. And then moved back to Lafayette in 2010 because I really wanted to be back in Louisiana and raise a family in Louisiana. And just felt like once you leave, you realize that Lafayette is really such a special place. And that, you know, why would you want to live anywhere else?
I know.
I came back in 2010 and worked at KTC for a little bit and then started at the Downtown Development Office and was there for 5 years. And now I'm in the mayor's office as of April of 17.
Wow. So you've done a lot so far with just everything that you're involved in. And it's weird that you moved here in 2010 back from Portland, because I moved here in 2010 as well, but I was born on an hour away.
Oh, okay.
So like an hour away north is pretty much South Arkansas, which a lot of people would agree. Some people in that area probably wouldn't agree, but... It's just a different thing. Going a couple of hours north, it totally changes.
Yeah.
So, you said you moved to Portland to do journalism,
mm-hmm.
and you said you were at CBS. Like, what type of journalism were you involved in?
Well, actually, sometime this is a really fascinating story. It's like my favorite dinner story to share. But I started actually on the assignments desk, really because I, right after college, was working as a graphic designer at a printing company, and you just sort of get comfortable, and you're like, this is great. For the first time in my life, I have, like, you know, health insurance and, like, retirement, you know, and I did that for a while, and then when I wasn't doing that anymore, I was either going to be moving back to Louisiana, having never really worked professionally as a journalist, or, you know, I started sending my resumes out. And my cover letter was essentially, listen, when I was 8 years old and a reporter came from Baton Rouge to interview my grandfather, who was a pretty well-known, like, plant guy. Like, he hybridized daylilies, Louisiana irises, and magnolias. I, like, at that point was in my Christine Amanpour phase where I was just, like, I knew I wanted to be a journalist. I thought I wanted to be, like, a foreign war correspondent. And I was just, like, Christine Amanpour was, like, my idol. Like, I wanted to be her. And so I wrote my cover letter basically, like, at that time, I knew I wanted to be a journalist. I worked for my high school paper, junior high paper, was a teen reporter at KLFY with Blue Office in high school. Like, that was my path. And my cover letter basically was to the news directors of these TV stations in Portland and saying, like, this is, I just kind of like taking a shot. And this news director at the CBS affiliate in Portland at COIN, she called me in and she says, listen, I don't even have a job, but based on your cover letter, like, I'm gonna find a spot for you. So she pulled me in and she put me on the assignment desk. I mean, I was all of, like, I don't know, 24 years old.
Yeah.
And she, so I started there. She's like, let me know when something comes up that you think you want to work on. And so really kind of cut my teeth there. And the head anchor, evening anchor, and I, we started looking into this cold case. It was the 50-year anniversary of this family of five that went missing on December 7th, 1965. And, sorry, 1957. And so we, like, got into the story for months. We worked on it. We turned in a 17-minute piece about it, and had gone to, like, the library and were looking at old microfiche and pulled a bunch of, like, autopsy photos. And, like, we tracked down the old detective's widow that, like, still had his notebooks and things. And anyway, so we did a story on this cold case, and that was like a fascinating story to work on. So that sort of led me down a path to doing more investigative journalism work, and really got into that more or less daily turn that we see sort of here, but the stuff that takes weeks and months that you're kind of chasing down and working on. So when I moved back to Lafayette, I wanted to do some of that. So I actually won an AP award for a piece I did with Hoyt Harris on the Jennings murders that we did. And I did, like, ride-alongs with the police, and, like, I love that kind of stuff. So that was sort of what I really got into, was producing and doing, writing those pieces.
That is fascinating. So you knew in high school that you wanted to pursue
third grade.
Third grade.
Yeah, 8 years older.
Wow, like, I don't know if I even knew. I knew that I liked building things and drawing, but at third grade, I didn't know, like, what my path was going to be, or, like, had any idea. I just figured I'd let it fall into place. And you already knew, kind of, like, this is what you want to do. But you said you also did graphic design.
Yeah, well, I mean, in journalism school, I learned, like, because I was electronic media, TV, we had to learn, like, it was just a class.
Gotcha.
We had to learn Adobe and InDesign and layout. And so it was just a skill I could call upon, you know, and so got, you know, pretty good at that, doing that on a daily basis. So, you know, no experience is, you know, invaluable.
Right,
you
know? No.
So
it's just interesting because my path was drawing and graphic design in high school. And that's how I moved to Lafayette, is through a graphic design employer. And now I'm doing essentially, if you want to call this, journalism.
Yeah.
And I had no passion at all for journalism. I thought it was interesting in high school. I was like, oh, that's cool. People that really want to, you know, dig into stuff and write. But I guess it took me wanting to be nosy enough about a certain thing.
Yeah.
To be like, I need to figure out how to put this out there.
Yeah.
And so, as far as the cold case goes, you did a story. You guys didn't solve the cold case, though,
well,
right?
Well, I don't know. Because
you don't know.
It's really, this may be a whole podcast. I would love to, because I can link to the video still. But basically, after working on this for a couple months, the Portland Police Department actually established a cold case division and reopened the case.
Oh, wow.
And they were just so, like, blown away. And they're like, we want to talk to y'all. We want to know, like, everything y'all know. And so we started sharing with them. And I learned a lot from them. And they said, basically, murders happen for three reasons: passion, money, or reputation. And so if you can fit anything in those three sort of, you know, causes, then you can sort of, like, work your way back from there. And so there were, like, twists and turns in this whole thing. I mean, the family was a husband and wife and three daughters that were 10, 12, and 14 when they went missing. And they had an older son who had, like, stolen a gun and was gay and, you know, in the 50s. And, like, just there were, and then he had, like, his partner was, like, used to go on walks with a 14-year-old girl. So we had worked out, like, all this crazy theory of, like, what could have happened. And so we essentially, like, kind of, in order to kind of, like, close it in our mind and just, like, okay, this is what we think happened. We kind of thought that, like, it was this one person. And so that had, like, killed all five of them and, like, pushed their car into the river. And, like, that's what we thought happened. And so when the story got published, I was at the news desk, and we started getting comments on the article, on the story. And I'm reading them, and I'm like, I see the person that we think did this, his name on there. And he's commenting, and he's like, oh, I knew the family, you know. And so, like, I'm getting freaked out, like, just telling you this, but he invited us to his home.
No.
And we went, and he's...
Wait, You went to the house. Yeah, we went to the guy's house. The person you think killed... Oh, my God. Yeah. No.
And so we... And then he said something really creepy, like, while we were there. And so... but, I knew that Oregon was a one-party recording state. So, you know, states have varying laws about if both parties have to know if you're recording a conversation or only one. And so Oregon was a one-party state. So I had, like, my recorder, like, in my jacket, like, the whole time. But so we turned that over to, like, the police. But, you know, it hasn't been solved yet. But coincidentally, I mean, this was 2007.
Yeah.
Coincidentally... like 2 months ago, a person in Oregon reached out to me. He's a diver, and he sent me a message, and he's like, "Hey, remember that story?" I don't know this guy. He's like, "Hey, remember that story you did with, you know, Jeff? Like, I'm a diver, and I think we might have found the car or something." And ooh. I was like, "What?" So
that's crazy.
Yet to be seen. I don't know. We could find out more information, but it's an ongoing story. So if you want to look it up, it was the Martin family that disappeared. On December 7th, 1957.
The Martin family. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I might have to look into that because this is interesting. And so obviously you're still here. The guy didn't like...
No, he didn't. Not yet.
Like, oh my God. So passion, reputation, and what was the other one?
Financial.
Okay. Oh, dude. That's so creepy.
Yeah, it is creepy. It's real creepy.
Well, we could probably talk about this.
Yeah, like that's saying it could be a whole podcast. Oh,
that's so cool. So I kind of want to get into a little bit more about what you do here. So you're a part of, or you are over the initiative of Create Lafayette. So kind of tell me a little bit about Create Lafayette and what and why is it important for Lafayette?
So CREATE first stands for Culture, Recreation, Entertainment, Arts, Tourism, Economy. It was an acronym that Mayor President Del Robledo came up with, and he announced it in 2017. And then in November of 2017, the voters approved a rededication of property taxes toward CREATE. And so I guess, like, the need for CREATE is there, right? We know that... If we can only figure out how to grow the cultural economy and the tourism economy in Lafayette, then we will attract so much additional monies to come into the parish, right?
Right.
And it's, you know, like my boyfriend of a long time is a landman, and, you know, when our area led the country in job losses in 15 and 16, like, that was my house too. Yeah. And it was a lot of people's houses in this area. And then we were, you know, kind of like 1-2 punch with the flood of 2016. And so, you know, it was such a moment of reset of, we have to do better. We have to think more out of the box, and we can't just continue to do the same thing that we've been doing. And, you know, I like to think of CREATE as something that we've really done ourselves before. I mean, Lafayette is such a we'll pull ourselves up by our bootstraps sort of spirit. And to me, CREATE is that in its existence. And I like to think back to the late 70s and the 80s when oil and gas, like, really hit rock bottom. And we all know that.
We came close to that.
Yeah, we did. But I also look to what we did in that time of great despair and of no resources. We founded things like CODAFIL in 1968. We had Festival Acadien et Creole 1974, Festival International 1983, I think. Downtown Alive, Downtown Development, the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra. All of those things happened when we really were in dire straits.
Right.
And at that time, it was the culture and the sort of renewable resource in our people that we chose to invest in and really prop up. And here we are. I mean, it's 2019 and we're all counting down the days to Festival International. And, you know, I wasn't around then. I mean, I was, but I wasn't.
Right.
And, you know, I have to think that at the time, those people that had the vision for what Festival International could be, or any of those organizations could be, were probably in the minority. Right. There were probably a lot of people like, this is a waste. This is, you know, we need to be doing other things with this. But they had their eye on the long game, and they weren't caught up in sort of the well, this will never work. And they had the vision and the leadership and the collaboration to really see this through. And now we all want to be the mothers of Festival International. You know, we would say, well, of course we would support that if that were happening today. Right. But you know, it's easy to do that with history. So I like to see CREATE as sort of in the moment of what have we really done since the 80s to move the needle in the same way that we did back then. You know, we had fiber, which was a huge step right. in that direction. But outside of that, there've been a lot of little wins, but there hasn't really been that sort of,
put it like a larger win.
So I'm hoping that in the same way, there's a little bit of a snowball effect and that we get away from, and those were great because they gave us a couple weeks a year where it was just like, we had all this revenue coming in and right. the economic impact right. was enormous. But I think now in the next generation with CREATE, we're really focused on how do we capture that revenue and investment 365 days a year? You know, what are we doing the other 50 weekends?
Do we need like a festival every weekend?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. I think that festivals and free music... Yep. Being the free music capital of the world has carried us.
Are we really the free music capital of the world?
I've heard that said a lot. Okay. Not Lafayette. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, I think we're ready to grow up from that. And okay. I think that, you know, having that access to free music is awesome and should definitely continue. But I think we're ready for...
A Coachella?
I think we should get away from... like only thinking events.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We need to be gotcha. Thinking about the infrastructure that supports those musicians outside of just paying them to play a free festival.
Right.
It's the, what are they doing Monday through Friday? How are they paying their electric bill? How are they growing as a business person and an entrepreneur, which is really how we've not seen. That's not our community perspective of our artists and our musicians. But we really need to cultivate that and provide them better access to, you know, how to best do their taxes and protect their intellectual property and do music publishing. You know, Chubby Carrier talks about this and I always use this, but you know, he grew up playing songs that his dad and uncles wrote. And when he did his first album, he played those songs. And then the record company was like, well, we own those. And he's like, excuse me, like, how do you own the songs that my dad and my family wrote? And they're like, well, that's music business. And that's not fair. And so then what Chubby did is he turned around and said, you know what? I need to own those. I'm going to have a record label. But he could have just negotiated the copyrights.
Right.
And so there are, but now he knows that, right? But what we hope is that not every musician has to learn that the hard way. And that we should be establishing this system of thinking for music and arts in our community that give musicians and artists the freedom and right to establish a value for their work and to have whoever is receiving that, whether it's a bar benefiting from people coming to see you play or an event that, you know, is going to sell more tickets because you're there, that, you know, we encourage, if you're asking an artist to come in because you know that they're going to provide value to your event or your business, then that should be the trigger that you pay them the value that they are going to bring to your business or event. And so CREATE, you know, we establish an artist compensation policy and we encourage other organizations and people to do that. But it's really, you know, it's really up to the larger community to help elevate that. And musicians need to start doing a little bit more of establishing their value and expecting that.
Man, so I agree. It's so hard though to be an artist, even like as a graphic designer, and in a way doing what I'm doing, I feel almost like an artist because, you know, artists tend to have this thing of like a struggling artist, you know, mm-hmm. they want to create something beautiful, but how do they get paid for that? Like, it's people want to see the beautiful work, but then they don't want to pay for the beautiful work. They think it should just come. And so that's a struggle, I think, for any artist, even musicians. I'm guessing any artist, because God, to get somebody to pay for you, like especially in Lafayette, we're so used to free festivals. So at this point, it's like to have a festival that you would pay to get into may be more difficult. I mean, I know Patty in the Park, you had to pay to get in there, but we also had a pretty solid, like, lineup. We had Wayne Tubes, we had Blues Traveler, like, Mm-hmm. Most people, I think, would think, oh, I need to pay for that, especially with Blues Traveler, because they're not from here.
Like, but that's, you just hit it. We're so saturated
with
musicians that it's like, it's our problem and our best, like, it's the best thing about us. You know, very famously, like, Michael Ducey will play Kennedy Center, and, like, he can't make a third of that in Lafayette. And so it's part of that we feel a certain value established with an outside group versus people that live and work here. And so, you know, I'll be as bold as to say that Create's really trying to flip that and say that we need to value more our local people because we got to take care of our people.
Yeah,
because
if we don't, they're going somewhere else.
Yeah, eventually. And so then it makes opportunities in New Orleans or Nashville or Austin or LA or New York look a lot more attractive. Right. So what I spend my days doing is thinking about how do we get resources in terms of whatever that means. You know, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's helping find access to other grant monies. Sometimes it's, you know, legal help or accounting help or whatever. Sometimes it's dental or medical or helping with bills. Right. And Love of People is a group in Lafayette that's really sort of taken that head on, and they're doing an excellent job of that. And so how do we start to bring those pieces together and look at the whole musician and how to support them holistically? You know, the state of Louisiana has a program that they call the Music Ambassador Program. And what they do is they, if you're a musician playing a show outside of Louisiana for 10,000 or more people, you can apply to get a stipend. And that stipend can go to part of your airfare or whatever, because, you know, the old joke is, you know, what do you call someone who's loading, you know, $15,000 worth of equipment, you know, in a $500 car for $50
right.
You know, that's a musician. That's what the life is. And so, you know, we really want to equip our music community with how can they build long-term wealth, whether it's through copywriting or songwriting, like with the solo festival, that was the one thing we were really focusing on, and building that wealth beyond just the Friday night gig, you know, because they're going to age. It's going to be harder and harder to, you know, play from 10 p.m.
Right.
to 2 a.m., you know, four nights a week, load all your stuff. And you know, so how do we sort of build that generational wealth that their kids and grandkids can benefit from their talent? And how do we sort of support that? It doesn't mean writing a check, but it could mean that, you know, I tend to agree with the state. I think our musicians are probably one of our best ambassadors. They're playing all over the world. Mm-hmm. And what is it worth for them to say, be in Munich and say, I'm from Lafayette, Louisiana. And there's a lot of people like me there, you know. I think it's worth a lot.
I think it's worth a lot. Like, I had, Sarah Dugay mm-hmm. on. And, you know, I was happy that she decided to break out the guitar and, like, sing. And I was like, I felt weird because I'm the only one in the room listening to her sing. And I feel like everybody should be able to, and you know, there was a lot of people that did listen to it, but I was feeling like I was by myself. I said, I don't deserve this. Like, this is not like, okay. But she told me she played in England or like mm-hmm. in that area. And like people, I didn't know that there was a country music scene in England. Like, that was so weird for me to hear, but she said that they loved it. And they just love her, I guess her shtick of like mm-hmm. being a country musician. And she's trying to, and you mentioned this, she's looking at moving to Nashville mm-hmm. because that's where she fits better. Mm-hmm. And it's so disappointing because I'm like, why can't you fit here? And I feel like every country musician goes off and they don't stay here. We have Cajun and Zydeco on lock, but all the other musicians, if you're an electronic musician, you're going to LA or Miami or anywhere that has that scene, but not here.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's frustrating because like one of our key strategies for Create, and I was pretty adamant about this, but there should be no other place that you go to learn about our culture and our people than Lafayette, Louisiana.
Right.
And the sad thing is like that's being threatened. I mean, you have people in Nashville that are like, we want a little piece of what Lafayette's got.
Right.
You have people in Austin that are doing the same thing. And so if we're not actively working to keep our talent here and you know, even attract new talent here, guess what? Those other cities are already after them. in some way or another. It could just be a brand that has attracted them.
Yep.
But we need to be doing that as well. And so in order for us to compete, in order for us to even hold on to what we have, we have to proactively be doing those things. So, you know, we're establishing a fellowship program through Create, which will be about 15 individuals that work in various sectors of Lafayette. So, you know, music, film, theater, dance, food, arts.
Yep.
And, you know, no one knows the music community like a musician. No one knows the dance community like a dancer or a choreographer. So it's really just tapping into that as a resource. And it's, you know, it's something that we can't do on our own. You know, I'm one person.
Yeah.
But it's really important to me that the musicians gather around how does Create help musicians. And it's important that the dance community gathers around Create and says, how do we help the dance community? And you know, it's easy and a little lazy to think of Create as, you know, oh, well now we just have this pot of money and we're giving it out.
Right.
But the truth is we barely spent anything last year, and half of our fund is actually set for parks and recreation and those capital outlay improvements to parks. And really parks it's easy to get kind of think about the culture side, but parks is really the genesis of Create.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that, you know, our parks are really underfunded. I mean,
you don't say.
Our millage is pulling in about, our millage from like, I think the 60s is pulling in about $2 million a year, and it's city only. We have 35 parks. We have 7 that are outside of the city of Lafayette.
Yep.
But, you know, at least Joel was smart enough to see that when Bruce Arden, Karen Crow, and Youngsville all have these beautiful recreation facilities that they've taxed themselves for to build, we're not going to get a parish-wide tax passed for parks and recreation to get us where we need to. And so having Create was at least an effort to try to have some additional funds to support parks and recreation and get us where we need to be. Is it enough? No. Could we spend that $500,000 like that? Yes. So our task is figuring out how to best invest in things that are either going to cut down on maintenance or expand our revenue opportunities through Parks and Rec, or attract new new competitions or new sport activities that are going to fill up our hotel rooms, get people eating in our restaurants and shopping here, and generating more sales tax revenue and hotel occupancy taxes that are going to, you know, just feed our economy further. And that's what we're really doing, is thinking about those metrics and how do we track the success of this. And that's really where our eyes are, is sort of the end. It's not really sort of the events feel good, like,
right. Those are always great.
Yeah.
But you need the other stuff to keep people wanting to come here instead of having to, for example, go 2 hours further down to New Orleans, because New Orleans, they have their tourism, they have it down. Like,
yeah.
People think, like, people in California that I've spoken to, they're like, oh, where do you live? I'm like, oh, Louisiana. Oh, you live by New Orleans? I'm like, kinda.
Yeah.
But no, like, so yeah, they were like, oh yeah, we're going to New Orleans in like a couple of months. You should come meet us. I'm like, I live in Lafayette.
You should come here.
Lafayette's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Check it out. But they're like, oh, we want to go to Bourbon. I'm like, well, I don't think we can provide the Bourbon experience, because there's some different.
I don't know. Jefferson Street sometimes.
Sometimes. Yeah. But Bourbon can get crazy. And I'm pretty sure Jefferson can get crazy too. Like if you listen to the news on a Saturday night or Sunday morning, sometimes it's like, I didn't realize that could happen. But yeah, I didn't mean to go off.
That's okay. But I mean, you bring up a good point. I mean, part of what New Orleans has that we will never, or that we don't have currently, that it's going to take a lot for us to catch up to, is New Orleans is walkable, bikeable. You can stay in a hotel and you don't have to worry about how you're going to get, how you're going to get someplace, or that you're going to walk out your front door of the hotel and find something that is interesting. And our big challenge is that, you know, downtown is so on the cusp, and it's like, it's both a little frustrating and also like, I love it that people feel like it's happened overnight. And to me, like, you know, It's like, I always think of that. I think it's Dusty Springfield. Like, you know, I was country before country wasn't cool.
There you go.
I feel that way about downtown because, you know, I was there, you know, 6-7 years ago when no one cared about downtown, you know, except for the people that were like diehard downtowners. But there wasn't a community feeling of we have to do better with our downtown. And so, you know, I love now that there's all a new crop of people that are like,
oh, definitely.
Love downtown.
I know, right?
And that's great. And, you know, it's so we work so hard over the last, you know, 10 years and way before that. I mean, Streetscape was 20 something years ago. But really in the last 10 years, I think we've really had been focusing a lot on like the strategy of downtown and what do we really need. And a hotel downtown was one thing, even a small convention center where we can start hosting conventions that put visitors in our downtown. They can just walk to the 35 restaurants and places that we have there versus having them sort of like down Pinhook at the DoubleTree where they're sort of on an island there.
Yeah, especially to get out of that spot.
Yeah, to better integrate. So, you know, I've been really inspired by the last year and a half of downtown revitalization. And, you know, the fact that this council and our mayor was able to finally get the Old Federal Courthouse unstuck after, you know, Joey Durrell tried and the last council tried. And just the team that has done that and gotten that going really, in my opinion, was the critical piece that I always thought it was going to be. You know, 2 years ago, I was with the mayor in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And it's a city that they have a fiber network, they have a university, but they're, you know, they're kicking our booty. Yeah. And like how what they've done as far as like branding themselves as a place that young people want to work and live and stay. And so we were in this conference room, and this lady who's like in charge of like the redevelopment of Chattanooga basically was like, well, you know, describe to me like where you think Lafayette is. and I said, you know, I feel like we've pushed this boulder up the hill, right? Mm-hmm. And we're right at the end, and it's either going over and we're gonna be set, or it's gonna come back on us and we're gonna be roll flat and we're gonna have to start completely over. And I will say with confidence that, you know, that was March of last year. So within a year, the Old Federal Courthouse has come, has been sold and moved. We have an RFP now for the Buchanan Garage, and not just the garage, but the pieces of property that front Jefferson Street.
One of the festival stages would be as well. So that was something that I spoke with Anita Begnaud Tuesday. She said something about the RFP and then the need for preserving the mural there, and also making sure that the Festival International stage and the staging area, which is also connected to the Old Federal Courthouse, right? There's like some stuff where the Festival International uses to like stage to preserve that. So is that the plan? Is that we got to make sure to preserve that, or is that?
No, I think it's just it's a growing pain of figuring out how festival evolves.
Right.
I mean, back to like an earlier comment I made. We can't sacrifice what needs to be there 365 days a year for 5 days a year.
Right. You're right.
We have to, that's like short-term thinking.
I know.
We have to be up here, right? We have to be looking at what's really going to move us forward. And a surface parking lot on Jefferson Street is 360 days a year is not worth the 5 days that festival gets to use it a year. I mean, it's lost in tax revenue from, you know, a retail or another building being there. It's not visually pleasing. It doesn't encourage walkability. It's the wrong idea of how to do that. You know, festival has been aware that at some point downtown
is
would
gonna
be,
change.
Yes. And that they would have to figure, you know, they have to evolve. And, you know, it's kind of amazing that they haven't before now. But, you know, we're talking about moving closer to the library now that Congress Street is a little bit close, more calm.
Slower.
You know, Grand Street Dance Hall is an amazing historic monument to music. I mean, Ray Charles has played there.
Oh, wow.
Like, I mean, everybody really that came through Lafayette has played there. And so there's even talk about maybe putting stage there so that we kind of capitalize on that sort of the weight of what Grant Street could be in educating people on what it actually is.
So the Grant Street stage?
Yeah, or something, you know, so something, there are spots. I mean, the good news is that there's a lot of congestion there on Jefferson Street, you know, with the five stages being so close together. And so I see an opportunity in kind of spreading things out a little bit more and, you know, expanding the footprint of festival really gives them a lot more room to work with and gives the, you know, visitors to Lafayette more of a taste of what Lafayette has to offer. And then we have a better downtown, you know, when they all go home and we're still here.
Yeah.
So, but between the Old Federal Courthouse and the RFP for Buchanan, we have two residential properties that are under construction right now and more in the pipeline. I really think that the Old Federal Courthouse was the thing that got the boulder off the, over the hill.
Yeah.
And it's not something that our previous leadership was able to do. And, you know, so kudos to our leadership now that was able to finally get that done. And I think it's only the beginning.
And I saw a rendering. I think the company is from China. They did a rendering of how the Old Federal Courthouse could look, at least from an aerial view. And I saw like a pool shot and just the way it looks. And it looks like it's going to be great. If that's the concept that they go with, I'm pretty sure there may be some adjustments on that. But
from China?
The company that the architectural design, the rendering came from a company in China. How? I don't know. I did some research on the graphic that Joel posted and I researched the company, figured out how to get.
Because Dyke Nelson's the architect and they are definitely in Louisiana.
So it's whoever designed the rendering. I don't know if it's, I don't think the company in China is an architect company, but they designed the rendering. Look it up. Reliance,
I challenge that.
Reliance CG.
Because, I mean, an architect, maybe it's the program software that's from China.
If you look at the image that Joel posted, it has Reliance CG.
Interesting.
Visual something on it. So I did some Googling, and it came from a company in China.
Okay.
Because they, you can check it out.
I'll check it out. But the architect that's doing the design work is definitely from Louisiana.
Well, that I don't...
It's not a Chinese developer.
Well, they did say the Chinese...
This sounds like...
The Chinese company did say that they're working with architects in Lafayette. So they're under contract. Because I was trying to get the renderings from them.
Yeah.
And they said, well, I had to contact the local people. So I'm like, now I need to figure out who the local people are. So there are some local architects on it.
Yeah.
But the graphic, I think, may have... been produced there.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
We can look into it more.
Okay.
But so we're running on 38 minutes here. And so there's a couple of questions that I want to ask you because we could talk about Create Lafayette and all the different things happening. So what are some of the places in Lafayette or downtown Lafayette that few people know about, but you seem to know about all these little hidden spots that are just kind of off the beaten path or... You know, what are some of the spots, what are some of your favorite spots in Lafayette?
Well, my favorite spot in Lafayette is probably the atrium of the Gordon Hotel. I just love that. They have this huge fiddly fig in there. And I like to tell people the history of that building. When the building was built in the early 1900s, it was didn't have electricity yet, and so it was built sort of in this U with a courtyard facing so that they would capitalize on as much natural light in the hotel rooms as possible. And then when electricity came in, they closed it off, and that's where you see the fountain and the tree in there. There's that building. I also like feel the history of that building when I'm in there too. You know, it was such like the spot to be, you know, when it was first built. And then in the 90s, it was actually vacant and there were like squatters in there.
Oh, wow.
And one particular squatter started a fire in the building, which then the city, you know, boarded it all up and it sat like that for a little bit. But at the time, Phil Lake at Community Development and Kathy Weber with the Downtown Development Authority came together and they put together a community development block grant with the federal government to not only restore that building, but also build the court, build the parking garage across from Vermilion, and also to take the Jefferson Towers building. It used to be one of those car elevator parking garages.
Okay.
And they applied for CDBG money to do all three projects at once, to convert Jefferson Towers from, because it never really worked well consistently, is what I am told. And if I told you what was torn down to build that, like even the car elevator garage, you would like cry. We had this beautiful, gorgeous historic post office that was built there. There's a bunch of old pictures of like old men just like hanging out. And so, you know, the post office back then was like the center of activity.
That was the thing.
You want to talk about some tea gossip? It was at the courthouse. I mean, it was at the post office steps there. But anyway, so the CDBG money came and they got all three projects approved. And so that's how the Gordon got renovated and the Vermilion parking garage got built and the Jefferson Towers got converted into the office spaces. So, you know, again, it's like somebody had the vision that this building needed to not only be saved, but it needed to serve a purpose and people needed to experience it. And so, you know, just the, because you look at it and you're like, oh, how great that someone always kept this building looking like this. And the fact is, they didn't. Somebody had to go in and have a leadership to fix it because they saw that it should be fixed.
Right.
And so, you know, that's why it's probably my favorite spot. But another new spot is at the top of the Lemoyne building where waiters' offices are. Mm-hmm. There's a atrium, I guess that's what you call it, but like a glass ceiling sort of balcony.
You can see out into the street.
Yeah. And over into downtown, and it's kind of a cool little spot there.
I did go to that spot. That's a nice spot. I want to go to the Gordon building. I got to check. Can people just go up there? Publicly?
Oh, yeah. You can. Poop Arts is actually in there. You can actually eat in the atrium.
Oh, wow.
Solo Violins is there. Yep. So, yeah, you can go. It's open during the day.
Okay.
Yeah. Go check it out.
Sweet. And I'm going to mention one more thing because we're almost at 45 minutes. You guys were part of planting some trees down Taft Street, right? What was the motivation behind that?
So I started a nonprofit organization with my friend Gretchen Vanacore, who's the director of sustainability at UL, back in 2013. It was an offshoot from the 705. Gretchen and I started Recover Acadiana after there was this ugly hurricane construction fence around the library when they were doing renovations. And I just thought it was such an ugly entrance into downtown that we could do a little bit better with that. And so Gretchen and I partnered with UL and the UL architecture students, all did art installations along the fence. And it sort of popped up overnight. And that was sort of how Recover Acadiana was born. It was, how can we take places that need a little love or attention and very cheaply through, you know, paint it or plan it, sort of make these things better and show that they're loved and taken care of. And so I'm the daughter of a horticulturist and, you know, my brother's a plant guy and my uncle and a couple aunts have horticulture degrees. And like I said, my grandfather was a plant guy. My great grandmother was.
So the whole family.
And so, you know, trees have always been sort of a peaceful thing to me and have always been around me and knowing what the trees were and what they do. And so, you know, Gretchen likes to say that the best time to plant a tree was 50 years ago, but mm-hmm. the second best time is today. And so in that spirit, we just thought that we could have more trees that are placed well, because we have a lot of trees.
We do.
But we don't have a lot covering sidewalks to provide shade. We don't have a lot that are near public transportation. Maybe you kind of get a little respite from the sun if you're waiting for a bus, or in our parks where you can kind of like sit underneath them or walk under them. So we're really trying to make it more comfortable to be outside, at the same time planting native trees and trees that are going to provide a good canopy and not have a wide root base like an oak tree that's going to, you know, disrupt roads
destroy the sidewalks and buildings. Yeah.
So we worked with my dad in figuring out what trees, and also land architecture, and figuring out what sort of trees would be best suited to be street trees? And so we did a lot of research and talked to those guys. And so we planted both sweet bay magnolias and single trunk hollies, Dahoon hollies, that are going to be small root base. So they're not going to impede on any of the infrastructure there, but grow pretty tall and out to provide a good canopy. So we, through that process, it took a couple years. We had money from the Daily Advertiser that sponsored these trees. And so we used this project and that existing funding to plant the trees to help the city come up with a tree planting policy, because it's really the Wild Wild West, yeah. Right? And so when Public Works really needs help in maintenance and learning how to, or needs help in having trees that aren't going to cause them a lot of maintenance issues, it was important that we put some guidelines in so that, right. You know, the good do-gooders like us had some guidance in how they really could do good and not just like pick something they like, right? And so there's still a lot of varieties to pick. You can pick something you like, but we want it to be, you know, a non-invasive species. We want it to be something that, you know, again, small root ball, good canopy, and where you plant them too, and not planting them in the field because you think that looks good, right. But planting them a little bit closer to the sidewalk so they actually provide some guidance there. So
I think that is something that I think we need more of, like you said, because anywhere near a major development, there is no trees.
Yeah.
Whenever Whole Foods came in, I was a little upset that they cut down all of the, I think it was pine trees that lined Ambassador, because it had a nice kind of like close, warm feeling. And then I was like, whenever they started construction, and I was like, okay, they're going to save the trees because they did all the dirt work and the trees are still standing. And all of a sudden the trees came down. I'm like, well, I hope they do something.
Yeah.
Because now it's like bare. It looks bare. They have, now I think the city does have like ordinance where you have to have so much green space or so many different things, but man, those trees were so nice. I don't know. I'm not a developer. I don't understand like the reason why you would have to get rid of the trees for whatever infrastructure you need. But we definitely need more greenery, like you said, near the sidewalks and all that. I think it would just be prettier.
Yeah. So now we have a tree planting policy, and we were the first to use it in planting on Taft Street. So I call up our little babies, and I live in Freetown, so I go like drive by there or ride my bike by there and just check them out as often as I can because, you know, you want to make sure they're doing good. Yep. And miraculously, one of them got hit by a car.
Oh, wow.
And we were sort of like scrambling, like, who's going to go, you know, we need to go fix it. And somebody did. So we don't know who did that, but that's like the best thing, you know. It's like people take ownership over it.
Wow. That's good to hear.
Yeah. That happened with the Lafayette sign, too. We had a couple, like, people that were authorized to repaint it, but three different people thought that they were, like, painting over it because they didn't like it, and so they were, like, calling the police and, like...
I heard about that.
...checking in, and you're like, this is great. Like, people have ownership over this piece of artwork, you know, and the sculpture, and... it's, you know, that sign has like, it like warms my heart so much. Like it's exceeded expectations completely.
And you designed the sign.
Yeah. Back in 2014.
Yep.
And we crowdfunded to put it in.
With Civic Side.
Yep. And like Butch and I have had a couple of cries over like, you know, like, did you see someone and propose to his girlfriend there? Or did you see someone got married there? And, you know, and he's just like, you know, we're both a little, you know, sensitive about it. But,
well, it's become a place where everybody that goes to downtown, if they're in that spot and if they see the sign, you almost have to like, oh, I got to take a picture here. As long as you have me and my wife took one right before Patty in the Park, and it was the first time I ever actually had a chance to stand in the middle and like be a part of the sign because I didn't want to be by myself. I wanted to have my wife with me, and so to be downtown with my wife and there, I was like, we gotta take the picture. And then, of course, her sister and her sister's husband took a picture as well. So I'm like, oh, look, I feel good. Like, I have my sign. I have my Lafayette sign picture. And so we're pretty proud of that.
And you can always get a new one because it changes.
Yeah, it changes all the time.
Yeah.
Kind of like with the spirit of the year, whatever time frame of the year, that's kind of the shape it takes.
Yeah, and by the way, if you're interested in painting it, you know, just get in touch with me and I'd gladly put you on the schedule.
Wow, that's good. So if anybody's listening, if you want to paint the Lafayette sign, get with Kate Doria.
Yeah.
You can make it your own.
Yeah.
All right, Kate. Well, this was great. There was so many more things that I probably had wanted to talk about, but we're almost at an hour at 50 minutes, and we have other stuff to do.
Yeah, thank you.
Cool, Kate. Well, I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much.
For information on sponsoring the Tea Podcast by Developing Lafayette, go to our website at developinglafayette.com and click Advertise.